Second case is United States v. Hardy. Is the appellant ready to argue? The government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Appellant may argue.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court, my name is Catherine Trukowski, and along with my co-counsel, Major Patrick Clary, we represent the appellant in this case. Chief Judge, may I reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal?
You may.
The Air Force CCA erred in holding that the appellant in this case waived rather than forfeited his claim of an unreasonable multiplication of charges for sentencing purposes simply by entering into an unconditional guilty plea. The appellant's plea did not contain a waivable motions provision. There was no discussion on the record that the appellant knowingly or intentionally relinquished his right to have the issue of UMC reviewed on appeal. And under the precedent of this court, particularly United States v. Gladue, the appellant did not knowingly relinquish this right. And as such, it was merely forfeited, and he is entitled to a plain error review on appeal.
Was this an unconditional guilty plea?
Yes, Your Honor, it was.
It was an unconditional guilty plea. But do you need magic words in addition to an unconditional guilty plea?
Well, Your Honor, according to particularly United States v. Gladue, it's not that there needs to be magic words. There just needs to be some indication in the record that the waiver was knowing and voluntary, not just a failure to raise the issue. So according to that case, which we rely on heavily, a waivable motions provision would be sufficient, even if it didn't specifically delineate that issue. But here, we don't have that. And in fact, the brief colloquy between the appellant and the military judge in this case seems to give the impression to the appellant that his PTA without that provision actually preserves issues for appeal. So to the extent that knowing involuntary...
Well, it's an unconditional guilty plea. You can enter a conditional guilty plea, but you have to have both sides agreeing to it. So is this something floating in the middle of conditionality? What is it?
This is something, and as we've laid out in our brief, and it's not our creation that there are certain categories of rights.
Well, no, it's UMC is our creation, for better or for worse.
Yes, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
This is something that can be waived, the idea of UMC. It can be waived. It's not something that falls into a category of rights that can never be waived, like jurisdictional type things and everything listed under RCM 705. It doesn't fall into that category. It can, in fact, be waived if there is an indication of a knowing and voluntary waiver. And that's what's missing in this case. That requirement is not overburdening any party. That can easily be satisfied, but it simply wasn't in this case. And without that...
What about the government's argument that it was knowing and voluntary as reflected in the statement on the record about what the maximum punishment was in this case? Therefore, they knew what they were facing, and they continued to go forward with the guilty plea. What's your position on that?
Your Honor, our position is that the acknowledgement of the maximum calculation of those charges is simply acknowledgement of that calculation. It's not an acceptance of the idea that these charges are not unreasonably multiplied. It's not saying that these are a reasonable...
If all those charges weren't there, would the maximum sentence have been correct?
Well, Your Honor, if the charges had been merged in a different manner as we've suggested, then the maximum punishment calculation would have been different.
I think that's what Judge Ryan is getting at. Wouldn't he have known that at the time he entered the pleas?
He would know, potentially, that there could have been a different calculation. But I don't think that his acknowledging the calculation of those offenses for their maximum is accepting that they're not unreasonably multiplied, because that is a separate legal analysis, not something that...
Right, but I think what we're getting at here is if the only way the calculus would have been different, a reduced maximum penalty, would be because of the merger issue, then I'm assuming that's the only way there would have been a different maximum penalty, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, then, if that's the only way it could be reduced, then wouldn't he know that by pleading guilty and not raising that issue, he was waiving it?
Not necessarily, and that's just not clear from the record. There's just not that knowing involuntary relinquishment. I don't think that that acknowledgement of the maximum rises to that level. I don't think that satisfies the standard under Gladue.
Okay, let me ask you another question here. forgive me, my knowledge about our cases is somewhat muddled, I'll say, but doesn't an unconditional guilty plea waive the issue of multiplicity?
In certain circumstances, barring facially duplicative right. specifications. That's correct, Your Honor.
Right. Now, isn't the issue of multiplicity a constitutional concern? In other
That's
words,
right.
you're infringing upon the protections against double jeopardy, are you not?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So I guess my question then is, notwithstanding what our cases say, or might say or not, wouldn't it be odd if an unconditional guilty plea could waive constitutional concerns, but not this particular one, which is not a constitutional concern? Or do you disagree with me on that?
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree. I don't. I think that they
you
are.
Even, you don't have to be respectful about it.
as the case law indicates, multiplicity and the doctrine of unreasonable multiplication of charges are distinct concepts. The fact that multiplicity derives from the Constitution isn't the turning point on what constitutes waiver. There's plenty of rights under the Constitution that are waived by a guilty plea.
No, I understand that, but I mean, given these two issues are similar, you don't think that it would be odd if we say an unconditional guilty plea waives the constitutional issue, but it does not waive this multiplication issue?
No, Your Honor, I don't. And
I mean, I didn't expect you to.
The reason is that multiplicity versus a UMC challenge go to different things. For UMC for sentencing is not seeking to disrupt a conviction. It's not seeking to overturn an otherwise provident guilty plea. It's not seeking to dismiss a charge. It's simply ensuring that the accused was facing the appropriate maximum sentence and was sentenced under that standard. So for public policy purposes, I don't think that there's an issue with treating them differently because they are different. And you're not looking to again, overturn any otherwise provident plea. It's just a check on the fairness and on the idea that this was the appropriate punitive exposure that should have been looked at when the sentence was imposed.
Right, but then you end up where I began, questioning you about his knowledge of what the maximum penalty was.
And again, which is why not raising it at the trial level only entitles him to a plain error review and not something more.
I got you. Yeah. Okay. I understand.
So to the extent that this...
You do admit it's forfeit.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Then that hauls us into the maw of plain error, but we'll get there in a minute. Go ahead.
Is plain error analysis part within the scope of the question that we have before us today?
Not specifically, Your Honor.
So why should we address it?
As far as the facts of this case, I don't think we necessarily need to get there, but to the extent that he is entitled to that review at some level, that's what we're asking for.
Counsel, can I approach the argument about the maximum sentencing from a different perspective, that even if they didn't waive the UMC argument, my understanding was at trial they agreed, for example, that the maximum sentence, I guess it was on charge 2, would be 105 years, but now you're arguing in your brief that it's 20 years. And my question is, well, didn't you just, even if you didn't waive the UMC charges, you're saying, how can you agree on one maximum sentence at trial and then come and argue it's a different maximum sentence on appeal and say it wasn't waived?
I'm not sure if I'm understanding you perfectly, but...
Well, for example, what did appellant agree was the maximum sentence at trial?
150 years.
150 years. Or 105 years, was it?
The total was 150 years.
150 years. I was talking just about charge two, but 150 years. And what do you say now is the maximum sentence?
In the brief, I believe we were referring to the idea of whether if those specifications were merged, as we suggested they might be, that would significantly reduce what the maximum punitive exposure would have been.
For example, you say in the brief, I think the charge two, that it would be 20 years. My question is, how can you argue that it's 100 and agree that it's 105 and then argue on appeal that it's 20 without having an issue of waiver? And just put aside what the reason, whether it's unreasonable multiplication of charges. I mean, you agreed to the sentence, and now you're arguing that it should have been agreed to what the maximum was, and now you're saying it's a different maximum.
Well, I believe that we're referring to if the merger had occurred, that would have been the maximum exposure for those specifications as merged. So I don't know if I'm again.
But you said at trial, dandy. 120, we agree, it's fine. You know, I mean, did you mean it, or did you have your fingers crossed behind your back?
Well, I think
I'm not talking about you. Sure. I'm talking about defense counsel.
I think that, again, the acknowledgement that those charges and specifications as drafted calculated to that particular amount of potential confinement time. I don't know that that's agreeing that you should be sentenced or facing that much. I think that's a different analysis.
Well, no.
Well, I mean, if I'm a military judge and I say the maximum penalty is 150 years and you say I agree, why would I then go and look and sua sponte on my own or otherwise think that it needed to be changed? Meaning think that I should, on my own accord, merge charges or merge specifications?
Well, Your Honor, the idea of the maximum exposure is only one of the kind of factors considered for UMC purposes. So I think that a judge could very well look at the charges as drafted or rely on the counsel's interpretation of the charges as drafted and say these add up to X number of years. But that's not necessarily the entire analysis of whether there is UMC.
Well, but it is in a case when defense doesn't raise it, and they didn't raise it until appeal. So I mean, you're the military judge, and you're just sitting there fat and happy thinking, well, they don't agree on anything else, but at least they agree on what the max is. And I can put that in my done category. So, I mean, it seems to me that Judge Maggs has a rather potent objection as to why this is actually waived.
Well, and I think in this case in particular, I don't believe the military judge thought that it was waived. If you look at the colloquy between the judge and the appellant, it seems that the judge actually advises the appellant that the PTA does not affect motions that could be filed because of the lack of that waiver provision. So that brings us back to the idea that reading into other discussions about the maximum sentence does not meet the threshold of that knowing and voluntary waiver. Maybe that could be a clever argument about you're sort of acknowledging
the
idea.
Well, it's more than a clever argument. It's what they said. You know, the whole thing is forfeiture is silence and speech is waiver, and here you've got speech.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that this court has looked at UMC claims on appeal that were not raised at trial, and in those cases, the same discussion about maximum punishment took place, and it was not considered to be waiver at that time. So that can't be enough, according to what
is currently.
But we
didn't have Judge Maggs then.
You can continue, counsel.
Our position is that there has to be something explicit in the record regarding the waiver of UMC, and that can be satisfied through a waive all waivable motions provision. It can be satisfied through a more explicit discussion between the appellant and the military judge regarding what specifically is being waived. And in this case, we have actually the opposite of that. There's a lack of a waiver provision. There's a comment from the judge that apparently the claims that he may raise on appeal are, quote, unaffected by the PTA. And that is an issue regarding the understanding of the appellant about what survives later on. And because it wasn't specifically mentioned at trial, again, he's only entitled to that plain error review, but he didn't give that up. That's not a high likelihood of success in many cases.
Well, that gets back to what Judge Olson was saying earlier. If we buy your argument, it's forfeited.
Yes, Your Honor.
Then that drives you straight into plain error.
That's correct.
Okay. What do you want us to do?
Your Honor, we're asking that the case be remanded to the CCA.
Okay, kick it back down there and let them do it.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's correct.
Okay.
The idea of UMC is something, again, that can be waived if it is done so knowingly and voluntarily, as this court has held in Gladue and as other cases have analyzed the issue of UMC. Again, UMC is not seeking to overturn a conviction for sentencing purposes. It's not seeking to disrupt a guilty plea. It's simply ensuring that there was fairness in the process, that there was an appropriate maximum amount of exposure, that there wasn't an exaggeration of the criminality involved in the case. And that is something that an appellate court can conduct an analysis of, specifically when it would be very easy to get rid of this issue at the trial level. If the government didn't want to have to defend against these types of claims, inserting that waiver provision would satisfy that. But without that, we just can't know what the appellant believed about his rights moving forward. And in this case, that's very
clear. Can I ask you one more question before time runs out? Now, you're saying you want this remanded back to the CCA so that they can do a plain error review? But
yes,
didn't the CCA do a plain error review on its own despite having found waiver? And I'm looking at footnote 7.
Judge, I see that I'm out of time. May I answer the question?
You may answer the question.
Yeah, I'm looking at footnote 7 in their opinion. I know you might not have it in front of you, but they say, although unnecessary in light of appellant's waiver, were we to review the issue for plain error, we would find the military judge to not commit plain or obvious error.
Yes, Your Honor. The court did kind of a cursory review after they had found that there was waiver, but we don't believe that they had gone through all the factors to determine.
But how do you know that? I mean, just because it's in a footnote?
It appeared that it's in a footnote. They don't go through any sort of specific analysis of that. So we would request that they conduct the full plain error.
Right, but doesn't that kind of give us, as they say, a preview of things to come?
Perhaps, Your Honor.
All right.
Thank you, Counsel. Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Stuckey, honorable members of the court, may it please the court. I am Major Matt Tusing, and along with Colonel Julie Pitt-Bork, we represent the United States in the proceeding today. An unconditional guilty plea waives a claim of unreasonable multiplication of charges. By volunteering to plead guilty, appellant chose to face the maximum punishment. It was dandy. After making that choice, appellant cannot now say it was unreasonable for two reasons. First, a plea comprehends a sentence, and a maximum sentence here. And second, the guilty plea waiver doctrine applies. A voluntary guilty plea comprehends the consequence of that plea. The voluntariness of it waives any claim that that consequence is unreasonable. In Lloyd, this court recognized that express waiver or voluntary consent ends the inquiry. In Broche, the Supreme Court...
Well, what the rule says is that it waives anything having to do with the basically substantive proof of the offense. Isn't that what it says? And you know, isn't this a little beyond that?
No, Your Honor. Rules for Court-Martial 910J says a plea of guilty which results in findings of guilty waives any objection, that relates to the factual issue
right.
of guilt of the offense.
That's what I'm referring to.
Yes, sir. As the Supreme Court noted in Broche, a plea of guilty comprehends a lawful sentence. For unreasonable multiplication of charges, whether or not it has to do with the criminality of the offense, the facts underlying the offense, and the appellant holds the keys to that when he's admitting or confessing to committing certain offenses. It's fact-centric.
Counsel, on that point, though, you're not suggesting that RCM 910J gets you there by itself, because 910J doesn't say that. 910J says this is the effect of a guilty plea. You can't argue the facts anymore. But 910, why doesn't that sort of by implication suggest that a guilty plea doesn't waive anything else?
Certainly. 910J doesn't set forth exactly what a guilty plea does and doesn't waive. There are things that a guilty plea waives that aren't necessarily factual, like we talked about jurisdiction and other particular examples of things that a guilty plea waives. 910
well, wait,
isn't...
A guilty plea does not waive jurisdiction.
Oh, that's right. Yes, I misspoke. There are a lot of things unrelated to factual issues that a guilty plea does waive, constitutional protections notwithstanding. I mean, the point here is that...
But this isn't constitutional, is it?
This is not constitutional, and for that reason, the guilty plea waiver doctrine does apply. The maximum punishment discussion does come up during the plea process for a reason. Here, appellant had a colloquy with the judge about what the maximum punishment was, and there was some dispute. They talked back and forth. It was 150, ended up being 150 years and 6 months, and the judge said, do you understand that solely based on your plea, you could be found, I could punish you to the maximum? And appellant said yes. And not only that, they took a break, an hour lunch, long break, and then came back, and then he accepted his plea.
So is your argument then that it's the guilty plea plus the failure to object plus the agreeing on the maximum sentence that gets you to waiver?
The government's position is that the guilty plea alone gets you to waiver for unreasonable multiplication of charges. In this case, there's more than that because he did discuss the maximum punishment and he walked into it knowing that that was going to be the outcome and he voluntarily agreed to take that on.
But what is, I guess, the basis for that? Like in the absence of a waive all waivable motions, in the absence of anything more, what's your basis for that?
Well, that as the Supreme Court noted in Broche, and I'll drive this court back to that opinion, a plea of guilty comprehends a lawful sentence. In that case, it was a double jeopardy question, and it was multiplicity, sure, but they were saying, look, when you stand up there, your plea of guilty considers what the natural consequence of that is going to be, and that's what happened in this case. He stood up and he understood that, look, I'm pleading guilty to multiple different offenses. By the very nature of him doing that, he's accepting the consequences of those offenses, and he agreed to them through his unconditional guilty plea.
Major Tussin, can I ask you a question here? U.S. v. Quiros is the analysis for unreasonable multiplication of charges, is it not?
Yes, sir.
Now, the first question under that analysis is, did the accused object? Do you agree with me there?
Correct, Your Honor. Right.
All right. Well, what is the purpose of that first question in your view? I mean, if in a case like this, why would we need to ask whether the accused objected or not if an unconditional guilty plea waives the issue?
Yes, Your Honor. That's a great question.
And I'm not trying to put you on the spot. I'm as kind of concerned about our case law as you are.
Yes, sir.
But I might even be more concerned.
Your Honor, I'm glad you put me on the spot because there's a good answer to that question.
All right.
Quiros, this court's decision in Quiros was specific about the CCA's awesome plenary power to consider this under Article 66C. It was not over whether or not an unconditional guilty plea meant that the waiver doctrine writ large.
I understand that.
So when this court set forth and looking at the CCA's decision about what factors to consider, which was ultimately pulled into the RCM. RCM 906B12 indoctrinates that opinion in Quiros. It wasn't specific to the unconditional guilty plea scenario. If you look at 906B12, it's not specific to guilty pleas. It doesn't say anything about what happens in a guilty plea scenario.
Yep.
So, you know, whether or not somebody objected is relevant for the broader question of the analysis without any respect to a guilty plea.
Okay, so the guilty plea is different.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah, I got you. All right.
So when the military judge goes through and says, you understand that you're waiving your right to trial of facts, confrontation of witnesses, your right against self-incrimination, why shouldn't we look at that as, okay, the military judge has listed these. There's nothing in there about UMC. Therefore, UMC should be handled differently. It's the argument that because it's not listed, that it was not intended to be included.
Yes, Your Honor. I think the point you're driving at is the knowingness of the right that you're voluntarily giving up. I mean, what evidence is there that appellant intentionally relinquished a known right? I think that's what you're getting to, sir. Ahern, there's no requirement that an appellant have specific knowledge on the record of all the rights they're waiving with their intelligent action that they're taking. Ahern didn't say no objection to the admission versus no objection to the use. He didn't have to waive in a way to show he understood the right in order to waive it. Like in Ahern, this court noted that it was right there. In MRE 304, his ability to, you know, his protections there. Likewise, in UMC is in 906B12. There's no requirement that an appellate stand up and say, I'm waiving under hearsay, I'm waiving for this, I'm waiving for that, I'm waiving for the other thing. So, you know, the military judges, would it have been easier for this court or future courts if the judge said that for every possible thing that an appellant waives when they plead guilty? Sure, there'd be nothing, that would be a good thing. But that doesn't mean that it's necessarily required to show that an appellant intentionally relinquished a known right. The guilty plea waiver doctrine states an unconditional guilty plea generally waives all defects which are neither jurisdictional nor deprivation of due process. And Judge Sparks, I'm going to go back to what you were saying a little bit earlier about noting the constitutional level of multiplicity here. That's not just something that the court made up. I mean, the United States Supreme Court in Alano said, look, the right at stake determines whether a particular right is waivable and whether the choice must be particularly formed, whether the defendant must participate in the waiver. It's the right at stake that sets forth that what we require to happen during the proceedings. Multiplicity is constitutional. Unreasonable multiplication of charges is not. In a guilty plea context for multiplicity, we don't even get to plain error. It's something else. As this court noted in footnote 2 of Lloyd, it's a unique situation that we give a less demanding look. The less demanding facially duplicative standard applies even considering the constitutional implications. UMC is not constitutional, so there's no reason to give it an even less demanding look that we grant multiplicity. An exception to the general plea waiver doctrine rule doesn't need to be recognized in this particular case. The logical reason why is, as this court noted in Harwood, that a plea of guilty waives appellate consideration of legal claims requiring a hearing to establish the factual basis of those claims.
All right, let me ask you this. Aside from your claim, which I think I agree with, that multiplication of charges is kind of the poor cousin of the multiplicity issue, so to speak. What's the problem that occurs or arises if you allow this to be a forfeited claim instead of a waived claim? What calamity might arise?
Yes, Your Honor. I could think of a few. What's the government to do when the UMC is never raised by appellate? Since no hearing has occurred, must the government put evidence on the record of the Quiroz factors even after a guilty plea? Evidence that there was no prosecutorial misconduct after the plea? What about evidence of increased criminality that they have to show? The appellate in the guilty plea process, in many ways, Your Honor, controls the reasonableness of the charging. They're the ones providing the facts the judge is going to be making decisions on. So even in a guilty plea context, if it's never raised, if appellate is silent, the peculiar situation we're in is the government would need to put evidence on the record since no hearing occurred, and that additional evidence of increased criminality might fall different than 1001B, for example, and it might be something the government's required to do then, despite an appellant's potential desire to let that sleeping dog lie.
So it puts the government, from your point of view, at a disadvantage since you would have the burden to show this on review.
The United States' natural reaction then would be front load. We would need one a hearing, and to put that evidence on the record even after a guilty plea.
Well, what about the mirror image of that argument where you say, kind of pulling in economics theory here, saying the burden on the government would be so minimal, so slight, in terms of getting to waive all waivable motions or simply focusing on the waiver of the unreasonable multiplication of charges, and the cost to an accused is so significant to have a right waived that if you're looking at it from that perspective, the burden should be on the government.
Your Honor, I'm glad you said burden, because the difference that makes all the distinction here is the choice to take on the burden from the government through an unconditional guilty plea. The appellant assumes that burden to and waives a bunch of rights. He would have the affirmative. He would have to take the affirmative step to withdraw that waiver as the process continued on. And to the point about the PTAs, and I'm glad you brought that up, sir. The PTA discussion here is an anathema. I mean, RCM 705, there's no evidence that the president intended 705 to define the limits of waiver. Appellant is making the same PTA Armageddon argument that the government tried to make and this court rejected in Chin. So a decision in the government's favor here does not mean a waive all waivable provisions never takes effect in the future. Sure, like in Gladue, that would be, look, that's the easiest way to point to say that's waiver. But in Gladue, this court, Gladue didn't require waiver. I mean, it doesn't stand for the assertion that appellate makes now that
it didn't require a waive all waivable motions for waiver.
That's right. Thank you, Your Honor. My mouth's getting a little ahead of my brain here. Gladue did not require a waive all waivable motions provision in order to waive UMC. The court specifically noted in Gladue that it need not determine whether it was facially duplicative, suggesting that it left the waiver doctrine for another day. That's today. The court didn't have to come up with seven different ways that an appellate waived in Gladue. They just looked at the most obvious.
So basically you want us to take the language that we used in Lee and Schweitzer and apply it specifically to this situation?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor, that's what we asked. The only other outlier case that I wanted to bring up that the appellant cited to was Pauling. Appellant saying, look, this court has not considered waiver in UMC in the past. The only other one is Pauling. And in that case, the government essentially conceded plain error review. Waiver was never considered. So whether or not that was a boondoggle to past appellants, it's irrespective of the fact that Pauling doesn't stand for the proposition that the plain error review applies to UMC.
Counsel, the appellant argues that your argument essentially makes the military practice of including waivable motions that's been around for decades completely unnecessary, that clause wouldn't accomplish anything. Does the clause waive all waivable motions accomplish anything under your theory? Because it doesn't waive unwaivable motions like jurisdiction or constitutional error. So what would that clause waive if you're correct?
Thank you, Your Honor. And so the government's position does not obliterate waive all waivable motions. 705 doesn't, which is the president's provision for recognizing PTAs, it contemplates what may be included, not what has to be included. And the important distinction here is the absence of words in the PTA. It can be proof of an infinite number of assertions you want to make. Proving a negative in this UMC context is exactly what Olano and Gladue seek to prevent.
Could you give me an example of a motion that would not be waived by a guilty plea that is waivable if there was no such clause?
You're asking if there is some issue out there that you would need to have a waive all waivable motions for in a guilty plea context. I can't think of one right offhand.
So then to follow up on what Judge Maggs is saying is, are you saying through your argument that waive all waivable motions is superfluous, that going forward in courts martial, there's no reason to have waive all waivable motions.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I think maybe the distinction here, this is a lot more narrow than that. Because of the right at stake in this particular case, we're talking about a guilty plea and the natural consequences of that plea. What a guilty plea means and what it does isn't everything. It's a natural consequence of the plea. It's the sentence we're talking
would it,
about.
Would it mean, would you still be able to say that specifications that were facially duplicative were subject to review?
Thank you, Your Honor. That would be a good example of how a waive all waivable. Are you asking if a waive all waivable provision would still preclude the ability to review for multiplicity, for example?
Yes.
Yeah, it certainly would. A waive all waivable motions provision, even in the existence of a waive all waivable motions provision, appellate could still raise an issue of multiplicity if it's facially duplicative.
Major Tusing, just getting back to Judge Maggs's question about this waive all waivable motions language or practice. What about, say, a motion for appropriate relief concerning a discovery issue? Wouldn't you still be able to put a provision of waive all waivable motions and that would waive that issue?
Absolutely.
Not?
Yes, sir.
All right.
Thank you.
So it doesn't make it completely superfluous.
No, it doesn't, Your Honor. And I would like to also tip back to talking about the whole purpose of having a conditional guilty plea as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's important to recognize that appellant did have an opportunity to preserve this issue just by making it a conditional guilty plea. And he didn't do that. That wasn't something that was part of this process.
Well, the government would have had to agree.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. But the government wasn't choosing to plead guilty. So the appellant took the responsibility on himself, including the consequences of his guilty plea. An unconditional guilty plea waived his claim because of consent. The judge told appellant that the maximum punishment would be considered, and then appellant pled. He could have pled conditionally, but he did not. He could have withdrawn his plea prior to the announcement of his sentence, but he did not. Appellant saw his plea through until the announcement of sentence, therefore, he waived.
Thank you, counsel. Good luck.
The appellant in this case did not knowingly and voluntarily relinquish his right to have the issue of UMC for sentencing reviewed on appeal. While it is possible to waive this issue, in this case we just don't have any facts that suggest that. As we have laid out, there's different ways in which certain rights can be waived. And some of those come
Mr.
from...
Mr. Kowski, can I stop you for a minute here? Am I pronouncing your name right, first of all?
For Kowski, yes. Yes, sir.
Okay, all right. What about the government's claim that this disadvantage would befall them if they were to allow unreasonable multiplication issues to arise for the first time on appeal? I mean, you heard his comments.
Well, as we've discussed, this can be easily dealt with at the trial level in several different ways. For instance, a waive all waivable motions provision would be sufficient, as would an extended discussion with the appellant and the judge about specific...
Right, but he's saying that in the absence of all of that, springing this issue on review, an appellate review, puts the government at a distinct disadvantage reasons he stated.
The appellant does not unilaterally have the ability to keep out a provision from a PTA. The government has just as much opportunity to agree or not to agree to certain terms in a pretrial agreement. So if the government doesn't want to have to defend these types of claims on appeal, they have to take that into calculation when they're finalizing those agreements, for instance. And that's the easiest way to deal with it. But under the rules and under the case law as existed at the time that the appellant entered into this agreement, he had no way of knowing that he was giving up that right. And moving forward, if there's a rule that a general provision waives things like UMC, then that would be enough. But here, there just wasn't any indication that he knew that based on the terms of his particular pretrial agreement and the discussion with the judge. And again, it doesn't put a burden on the government to negotiate the terms that it wants in that agreement as well. It goes both ways. It's a matter of simple contract law and what the understandings are in that agreement. And as I mentioned earlier, I don't think that this is a public policy issue to the extent that UMC for sentencing deals very narrowly with the idea of, was this an appropriate maximum exposure? We're not looking to overturn convictions that were otherwise good or disrupt guilty pleas that were provident. So the harm is very limited, and it's easily dealt with if the government wants to insist upon the inclusion of that waiver provision in a deal like this.
Can I just get back to, and I know you've been asked this before, but I'd like to hear your response again. The fundamental point of, during the plea colloquy, we've got the military judge saying to defense counsel, so, do you agree that the maximum punishment here is 150 years and 6 months? And trial defense counsel says yes. Now, the vehicle for the defense on appeal to attack that is unreasonable multiplication of charges. But by the mere acquiescence, the affirmative statement that yes, this is the maximum punishment, why should we or the CCA on appeal hear an argument, I know that I said it was the max punishment at trial, but now I'm telling you it's significantly lower? Why is that not waived, that issue?
Well, Your Honor, I don't, again, agree that the calculation of those charges is agreeing that they're not unreasonably multiplied. I see it a lot more narrowly. And Chief Judge, I see that I'm out of time. May I continue to answer the question?
Thank you.
Could the Chief please answer the question?
Sure. Yes.
So if you could explain how you thought it was, your view is narrower on that point.
It's a narrow acceptance of the idea that the charges as not merged add up to that amount of years. That's not necessarily an agreement that it's a reasonable amount of charging or that the charges shouldn't be merged. It's not an agreement in that manner. It's not specific enough. It doesn't meet that standard of the knowing waiver of that issue. It's just an agreement that the calculation is what they're stating.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Court counsel, thanks counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted. Court is in recess till 9:30 tomorrow morning.
Court stands in recess until